My name's John Moore. I'm a marine biologist living in Pembrokeshire. At the time of the spill, I was working based at Fort Popton in Milford Haven, working for an organisation called the Field Studies Council, who run Oilton Field Centre and Daleford Field Centre. And we're based there at Fort Popton, and an organisation, part of the Field Studies Council, called the Oil Pollution Research Unit, which originally had been based at Oilton. So that was doing consultancy work and marine biological surveys, and quite a lot of oil-related work, hence the name. It is said that organisation had originally set up in Milford Haven at Oilton, because of the oil industry development in the Haven. So we were doing oil spill related work already, and I'd been to a few spills. Oil spills was part of the work I did. And so when the spill happened, it was, well, OPRU was an obvious organisation to be involved with the response from the environmental side of things. So I did. I'd been working a few years before the spill. I'd had a couple of years out from OPRU on secondment to the Oil Spill Response Centre in Southampton. And as I say, I'd been to other spills. So this was not a new type of work for me to get involved. And so I got involved on day one. And when first heard about the spill, it was the evening before. It was actually a friend of mine who had a friend Greenpeace, and they'd heard about it already, and they called Francis, and so we knew about it very quickly. It was late at night, of course, so we didn't do anything then, but next morning, of course, I was straight down to West Angle Bay, and that was the start of, obviously, then a few months of involvement, which then went into years.
And there was oil on the beach right that very morning?
Yes, yeah, I mean, but it happened at night, and it by the time daylight emerged, then there was oil on the shore, fresh oil at West Angle Bay and along that coastline and extending along the south coast of Milford Haven. So it was straight away, straight in there, and it was, you know, it's an emergency response, as these things are.
So what was your initial, what was the first step that you had to take?
I had no official role. You know, this was the OPRU was a research and consultancy company, and yes, it was obvious that we would get involved, but we had no official requirement to do so. I suggested very early on that we should get to a number of the monitoring sites that had been pre-established on rocky shores around Milford Haven. I suggested that we should get out to those sites, or a number of them, as many as we could do, before the oil had its severe impacts, to make records of what was there before, you know. Behind this was, for me, I'd been to the Breyer oil spill in Shetland in 1993. And again, that wasn't the first spill I'd been to, but it was a big one. It was a big one for UK as well. And it was a spill where there was a strong reaction early on by the environmental organisations that they weren't very interested in trying to set up any sort of monitoring or baseline at the time of the spill. Their priorities were in responding to the wildlife and other aspects of the environment, dealing with decisions about the response. And so the idea of actually trying to provide some sort of baseline of what was there at the time in photographs and samples and records was at that time in the Bernal Brace was considered not to be a priority, and there was no, people said, no, we're not going to bother with that. You know, and I thought that was a mistake, and so I felt strongly at the time of the Siempre spill that we should try to put some effort into establishing a baseline. And so I put that to the environmental organisation, the environment group, which is part of the Shoreline Response Centre. And that was taken up fairly readily, I'm glad to say. So we were given a role very early on to get involved as advisors, but also as surveyors to go around the shores.
So how many of you were there?
So from OPRU then, there was probably 5 or 6 of us were immediately then out around shorelines making records, going to the sites that had been pre-established.
And all marine biologists?
Biologists and other marine scientists. At least one was a sedimentologist, Jan Smith. I think most of us were marine biologists. And yeah, so that was the start of it. But the environment group working on establishing more of a baseline and getting more involved with monitoring. So I was fairly quickly given a role there as to help with coordination of that recording and setting up of sort of monitoring, the basis of what was eventually become a monitoring program. That was early in on that process.
So it has had a huge impact on your...
It has. It's a funny thing to say that an emergency, a big environmental impact like that furthers people's careers.
Mm.
But it does. I mean, I'm not. It's, you know, there's a number of people who've been in a similar situation. Oil spill response and emergency response generally, fire brigade and people who deal with emergencies. There's lots of people like that, and people might be surprised that the oil spill response industry is actually a very large industry, mm. particularly in the US, where there's legislation requires. Response not just for cleaning up beaches and making some recompense to the people who've had, you know, their lives affected, but also for the environment. In the US there's a environmental legislation which requires a response, and it's a big industry now in the US but also elsewhere. And even in the UK, it's a big industry. There's all the equipment manufacturers, and it's big equipment. You know, dealing with oil on the water and out on the sea is big. I mean, in some ways, I'd say that oil spill response industry and community is on the scale of fire brigades in a different way. You know,
so it's really specialised. Very.
It is a bit specialised, but oil is so part of our lives everywhere in the world, isn't it?
Mm.
And so. Transport of oil and the oil industry generally, and therefore when spills happen, you know, and they do happen, it isn't just the one off, you know, the big ones like the Siempre that everyone remembers. You know, there's lots of spills, and there's a need to sort of set up those contingency plans and have all that equipment ready to go at a moment's notice, maintained and with trained people to use them. And so it's a big industry. I mean, people might be surprised at how big an industry it is. In the UK and Europe generally, it's not as big, but there's still lots of people in who are involved with oil spills on a day-to-day basis, and in training and equipment manufacturing and setting up contingency plans and the government level, advising on what you would do if there was an emergency, and you know, the international level, arrangements between countries. You know, there's a political angle to this as well, which is big. And then there's environment, and the environmental impacts and the effects of oil on the environment, and that's and where the oil goes, and the fate and weathering of oil, the chemistry, the physics, the biology. It touches so many aspects of the environment, and there's a lot of people who do work on that. So it was a big thing for me, and it has furthered my career. I mean, I was already involved with oil spills, but I certainly don't think of myself as an ambulance chaser in that sort of vein at all. But oil spills are a part of my work, and the Siembla spill was a big one midway through my career, and it's actually through it, you know, it has developed my career. And that's a funny thing to say, but it's very true. And the Siembla spill was it's not something that I think of in an emotional way. I am to a very large extent a biologist, scientist, and I'm fascinated in the environment and biology, and I have a very strong view that we've got to be taking care of our environment. I wouldn't say it was a passionate or an emotional response, but I am fascinated by it, and I just see logically it's inescapable that we've got to look after it. And so so spills are damaging, and they're not as damaging as many other things, but it's horrible to see marine pollution, and on the scale I've seen at a few spills, it is really horrible. But it was fairly early, I'd say it clear, and because of the experience I already had, it was fairly clear to me after the oil had turned around at least and was going out of the haven and away from the shorelines, that, and because of the type of oil, that it was not going to be a long-term environmental impact. I'm certainly not an apologiser for the oil industry and the effects of spills, but it wasn't going to be the long-term effect that a lot of people assumed it would be. And so I did find myself in a strange position where I was trying, in many cases, wanting to study it, but not getting overly emotionally involved with it.
So you had a very pragmatic approach to it, because
I suppose so. Mm. Yeah. Yes, it was.
At any point before, had you thought, I wonder if this is going to happen on our shores? Is it going to happen in where I live, or not something you could?
I'd been involved with spills in Milford Haven before, the LMR spill in 1989, for example, and well aware of other spills that had happened in Milford Haven and around Skoma, and not very far away. So it wasn't something that I didn't think would happen, but yeah, I wasn't waiting for it to happen by any means, no.
And even though you were practical about it and you had experience of it, did it at the seeing, because I presume you were living here at the time, did the initial response, was it a shock, or was it just something that you felt we've just got to get on with it and deal
just
with it?
Get on with it, actually. Mm. Yeah. I'm not sure that I can remember what my response was at that stage, but I think overall would just be the right, what I've got to do, trying to work out straight away what to do to, and as I say, because of my previous experiences and the Breyer spill in particular, immediately keen to try to get a response going where we could actually describe what the effects were, and having that baseline and making records and taking photographs and taking samples, and I wanted to be involved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was the early part of it, and developed, you know, bigger and bigger scale from that, and I got more and more involved in the in that response, both with the I call it the Shoreline Response Centre. Before I didn't, it was actually at that time the Shoreline group was called the Joint Response Centre, the JRC, and the environment group within the JRC was where I was sort of based for quite a long time, but largely as a sort of part coordinator of the this developing monitoring framework, and getting, you know, there are lots of marine biologists in Pembrokeshire because of Dale Fort Field Centre and Oralton Field Centre and the conservation agencies, and because we're surrounded by sea. So there's a lot of marine biologists in Pembrokeshire and there were at the time. And I knew, you know, most of those individuals and wanted to get lots of people involved in getting this baseline and this monitoring framework going. So I was a bit pushy in those first stages. You know, I had a certain amount of vision. Whether it was a good vision or not, I don't know, but it was certain. I had a certain idea of what, you know, things I wanted. I liked the idea of getting going, so I was pushing those. And
so, can you explain what they were then?
Well, it was about trying to look at all the different resources of the environment that could be affected by this spill, and being fairly trying to get a complete picture, and using the experience that we had down here and the work that had already been done in the survey areas that had been surveyed before, and we had historical data for, or recent data even, in many places, using methodologies that were tried and tested, but also developing new ones that were relevant to the particular areas. So I had all these sort of ideas, and I was creating lists and of people and work that's been done before, and different resources, and how we could actually approach these and getting in early. I've been a keen developer of the idea that we need to capture the information, because about things that fall over and die early on, and capture that information before they disappear. The wildlife that dies but you don't see it, unless you're out there and recording it, and people sort of mentioning things that they've seen but not recording it or photographing it, was, you know, I didn't want that to happen. I wanted people to be getting this information and keeping it for future use. So I was being pushy, getting people to do that sort of recording and trying to create a framework and structure for how we set that up.
So your team were working and going back to the Oralton Field Centre, is that where you're?
We were based at Fort Popton at the time, the Oral Vision Research Unit. It wasn't my team. I was being pushy and I was helping to coordinate, but yes, I was making the most of the people I could.
And presumably then you were feeding back that information to other organisations or?
Well, there wasn't any organisation at that stage really to feed information into, apart from the environment group, which is in the Joint Response Centre. I was trying to make sure that everybody knew what was happening, but it was, it's an emergency, and in the early days, keeping everything coordinated and keeping a good, getting a good structure for that response set up isn't easy. But it gradually developed, and we, I think we, kept everybody in the loop early on, and as it went on through, and more people getting involved, lots of people obviously from outside coming in, so fielding lots of calls from universities and organisations, people who I knew from elsewhere who were interested in getting involved. And then there was, the development of the more formalised official response to this, which ended up as the SEEK, the Sea Empress Environmental Evaluation Committee, and that quite large group of people who from different parts of the UK who came down to establish this monitoring setup and lots of different projects, and I became part of that. So it was a it was, I suppose, best part of 6 months' work for me. Not, I was doing other things. I had other projects on other surveys and other areas and things. But over the course of a year and a half, 2 years, I had effectively, probably about 6 months' work just on Sea Empress. And I still have work related to Sea Empress. I do training courses, and the Sea Empress spill provides a fairly interesting, because you have so many different habitats within a small area, just within Pembrokeshire. You've got such a wide variety of different resources. The diversity of Pembrokeshire environment and the marine environment is within a small area, it's massive. You've got all these very sheltered environments in the estuaries, in the Milford Haven and the estuaries, and then other estuaries on the south coast of Wales, going up to Bury Inlet and the Three Rivers. You've got the open coast, with all the birds, you've got cetaceans, you've got marine life in the subtidal, and you've got nature reserves, SCOMA. SCOMA surveyed the team, the marine reserve there. They obviously were doing an awful lot of things, and making sure that they were making sure they had information recorded for areas affected around the island. So all these different resources, all these different aspects of the environment in a fairly small area. And I don't know of another spill that has that in such a small area, such a variety. And we also had an enormous amount of pre-spill information. Because Milford Haven is an oil port, there is an awful lot of survey work that's been carried out. And because of the Milford Haven Waterway Environmental Steering Group, there was a number of monitoring programs that have been established in Milford Haven. And because of Oralton Field Centre and Daleford Field Centre and the marine biologists and teaching shoreline, teaching shores, teaching sites, there was an awful lot of data. All these marine biologists, the marine reserve, there's a lot of pre-spill data. So that and the variety of environments made it an enormously interesting place for spill studies.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a positive thing, but the amount of research, research that has come out of it.
Absolutely, enormous amount. And I know that Blaise Bullimore also feels, as I do, that we've got to make sure that information is and all the reports and so forth that were produced from all that work is archived and available for anybody who needs to see it, which it isn't at the moment.
It isn't.
No, it isn't available at the moment. And that's, you know, the way things happen with most of that work was funded by government agencies and with government money, and things change in governments, and so organisations change, and now we've got not Natural Resources Wales rather than Countryside Council for Wales, and we have a change in priorities, and things get lost, and I just don't want all that information to get lost.
So how are you going to stop that then?
I'm doing things personally with my own archive, but I just hoping that we can get an archive established at somehow in some form for all that work that was carried out, and that's a good side. I don't think it's going to get lost because there's Blaise, myself and others in Pembrokeshire do have a lot of that information, and just need to find some official place for it to become lodged. So yeah, there's no great risk at the moment then it's going to get lost, I don't think, but just we've got to find a way of making sure it is for the future.
And that would require you doing it off your own back, basically?
Initially, but I'm hoping eventually that there will be some repository that will be more official and safe.
It's quite unbelievable that there isn't, isn't it? It's just all that work.
Yeah, it is, and it's we could very easily get onto a hobby horse of mine about the government-funded research and all the work that that is done with money by agencies and. There is an enormous amount of information and reports that have been written which are not publicly available, and I think it is I think it should be made a priority, and it isn't at the moment by most of these organisations. They have other priorities, and you can understand that, with the way that things are happening in the environment and the agencies we have in the UK. And the priorities that there are from government. So this historical information isn't by senior managers really thought about. But the technical people within the agencies feel like I do that we should not let that information
disappear.
And it is in some parts of there is some information has already been lost from not that long ago. Raw data and reports that were not were limited circulation at the time.
Why is that then? Do you think it's just been overlooked, or has it's just not given?
Well, the libraries within the sort of information and publication departments within these agencies don't get a lot of funding. The background to all of this is funding and government funding, and the priorities that are set for it. You can very easily see how it happens. Stuff that's not on people's desks at the moment and gets forgotten, there are within the agencies there isn't the money and the people who have the interest in those, the technical people, staff in those organisations, don't have the time to think about it, to put the pressure on their own organisations. Mm. Sometimes that's difficult as well within the organisation. So from outside, we've got to be putting the pressure on them. Mm. Anyway, it's getting a bit away from Siempris, but it's, I think it's a Siempris, the reports that were produced from Siempris, all that information, I think, is a... It could get lost, and it would be a very silly thing for that to happen.
So going back to the early stages of the first few days, I mean, what I get a sense of you is that you're had a very pragmatic, calm approach to it.
Yeah.
So did you sort of, were people asking you about stuff? Were you like a voice of a sort of reassuring people that you felt it would get, it's not as bad as it looks?
I don't remember a lot about that. I almost certainly did with my background and my views on what I thought was likely to be happening with that spill, then yes, I would have been saying that sort of thing. I don't have the charisma to be able to put across those sorts of views to people who didn't want to hear it. Mm. And so I'm well aware of that, and I wasn't going to try too hard when I just get on with what I think I need to do. Yeah. Yeah, so no, I'm a backroom person really, but I had strong ideas about what the things I thought would be good to do, and I was pushy enough to try to get that going, and I in my small way I think I did help to develop that monitoring program and certain aspects in particular.
So was it between you and your colleagues, was it like a network of different, presumably there were people in different parts of the coastline, because were you very much centred on West Angle Bay, or were you all over?
No, I was all over really, South Pembrokeshire in particular, I suppose, just because it's close to home, is where I spent more time, and of course more oil was on the south side anyway, in Milford Haven, and then round to Tenby. So I was going back and forward to lots of different sites and take my own photographs of it. And of course, in those days, we had slide film in those days, and going through my old slides, looking at those and thinking, gosh, I wish I'd been a better photographer. I wouldn't say I was in any central position, but I was out and about a lot, and I had a lot of different contacts with people who were doing things in different parts, different places. Trying to keep that coordination to a certain extent.
And did you feel that you had to kind of... I'm just thinking now how chaotic it must have been at first, with people all over the place, and
yeah.
for scientists and people like you to kind of take control of certain areas without it being totally cleaned up. And
there were places where we actually established leave alone sites, because I was involved with the Joint Response Centre and some of the people who were making decisions there about spill cleanup around the shorelines, then I was able to put them up to Penrith and influence part of that, coming up with ideas of where to leave alone, the leave alone sites, and to have those surveyed in a formal way and watch the changes that happened to those. Was one of the studies that we were carrying out. The results of that were surprising to a lot of people, how the the oil was taken away from those sites almost as quickly as they were cleaned, naturally. It was a light oil, it was mostly on a wave exposed line, wave coastline. It doesn't persist in those environments, that sort of oil. So it was, oil can go an awful long way. A little bit of black oil can look devastating, and it's quite surprising how quickly it can go away. But this wasn't a little bit of oil. This was 72,000 tons of oil. You can still look at that amount of oil and then look at the whole sea and see that it's actually a small amount in that scheme. But when it's concentrated on a beach, on a shore, or in Robin Crump's rock pools, then it's horrible.
Poor.
Yeah, the damage that does.
So can you sort of recall when you felt that there were real signs of improvement?
I don't recall. Well, I suppose I do. Yes, I do. I mean, it wasn't very soon before. When we talk about recovery from spills, the first stages of recovery, and this is, you know, well established from many years ago during the after the Torrey Canyon spill, I suppose, in 1967. Say the first sign of recovery is when you start to get opportunistic species colonizing and rapidly growing on those areas of rock or sediment or whatever the area has been affected. And that was being seen within weeks of the spill in certain places. West Angle Bay started to go green. Pretty quickly, you know, within weeks, there was those shorelines were going green, and that you can say is the first sign you got the first early colonisers of that of those habitats, and that's a very well established part of that process of recovery. It's been known for a long time. So when we saw that, I suppose that was it, but also. Places that were oil was disappearing from without cleanup activity. As you get wave action onto shorelines, where maybe the bulk oil has moved on, and the wave action is taking away the remaining oil. So you can see it fairly early on. But. You can still, you know, it still looks like an awful lot. You know, the coastline was still as, you know, black in many areas. Milford Haven didn't get as much oil. I mean, if people have said we were lucky, in a way, it could have been a lot worse if more of that oil had gone into Milford Haven and gone up into the estuaries rather than the relatively small amounts that did. It could have been a very different thing, even though it was a light oil. More oil had gone up into those salt marshes and right up under those into those marshes, with lots more birds coming in over the spring, then could have had more serious impacts. Bad as it was, you know, with bird impacts and other things, it could have been a lot worse. But even then, with the relatively small amounts of oil that went in the salt marsh areas like Martin's Haven on the south coast of the Haven. Went black, and in Pembroke River, the marshes around Pembroke River, they went black. But you actually go and look at how much oil was there, it was just a thin film, really.
So it went black only on the surface, or as a.
Yes, that's right. The amount of oil that was in there was relatively small, but just spread so thinly. Then when oil goes on the sea, this is why it's so difficult to clean up oil. It just spreads. Very, very quickly, it spreads out, particularly light oil like that Forties blend oil from the Sea Empress. it spreads out, and within a short period of time, it's 0.1 of a millimetre thick, spreading over many square kilometres of sea and then shoreline. So it doesn't need to be thick. You know, the thick patches actually are patchy. But the spread of a thin layer of oil, which may not have a very acute effect, is everywhere. Yeah. But we need to try to identify the thick patches, from distinguishing that from the light overall thin cover of oil is one of the difficulties of dealing with spills.
And are you still involved assessing other types of oil still in the?
Yes, spill response and spill. I do these training courses. I do environmental assessments. In case of spill contingency plans. Writing documents on effects of spills and monitoring after spills. It's still probably about half my work. I went to a spill in Ireland a few months ago, in June, to advise there and carry out survey work. So yes, oil spill response and spill oil spills is still a large part of my work.
And how did you get to find out about this project then? Were you contacted by Abigail?
I was contacted by Abigail. She had picked up my name. 10 years after the Siembra spill, I wrote a document on the 10 years after what the status of the environment was. That was funded by the Countryside Council of Wales at the time. So it was a review of the information that had been prepared up to that time, and most of that work though had basically finished within about 2 years of the spill, because the impacts were not long term. 2 years may seem like a long time anyway, and it is. But there was little to see 2 years after the spill. So 10 years after, it was sort of trying to make, yeah, just checking to see if that really was the case, what was still there. So the review document that I did was, I don't know if that was what Abigail picked up on, but yes, she contacted me.
And you were obviously very happy to be involved, or, I mean...
Yeah. As I say, it's still part of my life, my work, and I do like the idea. In my time of life, I'm increasingly liking the idea of passing on information and... like to help students and others learn from what we've done. As I said, I want the information that came out of this spill to go on and be available to people in the future.
I mean, from your own perspective, do you think big lessons have been learnt, or do you think there are gaps?
I think some big lessons have been learned. But in terms of the environmental impact of this, I mean, there's lots of detail, but the majority of it is reconfirming what was already known. But a lot of that information was just wrapped up in scientific publications and within a small community of people who had worked on spills. So I think Siembra's made some of that information more mainstream and more available. And it provided, you know, because of the amount of pre-spill information we had, because so many different resources were affected, it has helped to make available, you know, or some of the truths of oil spills and their effects of oil spills are now out there more than they were before Siembra. Yeah, so And there's obviously the various aspects of response that came out of the inquiries after the spill that have definitely helped response and affected the way it's response has been done, not just in the UK but elsewhere as well. So there have been useful lessons.
I mean, what's interesting about the different perspectives that we've got talking to people is that for a lot of people it was a one-off event that affected them, but for you it's kind of still lives within you, doesn't it? Because
yeah,
it's something
it
that is just
yeah.
always there. It's kind of influenced everything that you do now as well. Well, because you're obviously involved in it before, but it's an ongoing thing.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm sure people get bored of me mentioning Sea Empress. But it is important to me. And there are still aspects of it. There is still oil on the shore. I took people to see those then.
Mm.
Couple of weeks ago to show oil remaining on the shore, and in talking about it with somebody I know, I understand that there is actually some more somewhere else, which I wasn't aware of over near Dale, so I must get to see that as well.
It's interesting talking to Blaise, because he was talking about samples in the water and about like the Sea Empress almost memory signature of it. You can still
Yes.
And other things from...
Yeah, seabed sediments. There
yeah.
are... there are. There's oil. The oil industry has been in Milford Haven for a long time, you know, since the 60s, and there's... and while it's a very... unlike some marine inlets, there's a strong flow of water through it, and so we don't necessarily get persistent oil remaining, but you have. Now, in the muddy sediments in parts of Milford Haven, there are more than the signatures. Now, there is oil sitting in the strong concentrations of oil still remaining in some sediments areas, and that's because the oil industry has been here, and probably there's this big shipping place. And it certainly was in the past, and not all oil is like Sea Empress. You know, the heavier oils.
Mm.
Are much more persistent, so that stuff is still there, and it may not be having any gross, acute impact on the marine life, and that's not acute, a gross impact on the environment, but it will be having an effect. And so many other things are having an effect, human impacts.
Yeah, and it's probably minimal compared to a lot of other things.
Yeah, I don't know. I think so.
Mm.
But I think we still really don't understand all the things, the way that man affects the environment. My great concerns are with man-made chemicals that aren't designed, that don't biodegrade.
Mm.
I've got much greater concerns about those and the way they're accumulating in our environment than I have about petroleum hydrocarbons.
What I found really interesting talking to Blaise was that just talking about what they did with the waste and how it was churned, some of it was ploughed into the, or given back to the landscape to break down.
Yeah.
And because it's a natural product anyway, so yes.
Yeah.
In a way, it's less offensive.
Yes, it's very, it's certainly the black oils, crudes and heavy fuel oils and things are, they're so black and obvious, but it is a natural material that will biodegrade, by far the majority of it anyway, will biodegrade relatively quickly, and that can be forgotten, but...
mass production.
Yeah. Yes.
So, going back to that idea of it being not, it's not a sort of continuous thing for you. Is there anything else you feel like you would like to just add about it, or to sum it up, or?
No, I don't think I can summarise it. It's different for everybody, but football, I said what it is for me, really. You know, I do treat it fairly dispassionately. I have this fascination with biology, and therefore a fascination with how humans affect it, biology. And I don't think of the of oil spills generally, but and the Siempris being one of those that has a massive impact on the environment, and certainly not in the long term. I don't think of it in those terms, it's some ways it's been a way of getting studies carried out and information carried out about the environment, which would be useful for not just for as a baseline for spills, but for other things as well. Sorry, I'm not really answering your question.
No, you are, because you've already, in a sense, it's kind of like the bigger picture for you, isn't it? Is what your real concerns are, compared to the real threats that we're faced with
in
now.
That context of the environment as a whole and the threats to it. I may not put oil spills high up there. They can do in localised areas. Then there are places in the world where I am they have caused very long-term severe damage. Siempre wasn't one of those, but it's there are other environmental concerns that I have, and I'm afraid I'm not very positive about this. I'm a little pessimistic, to be honest, about the environmental effects of humankind. And then I think about in geological sense, this may not just be a blip.
A blip in time.
Yeah. But then we come back to our kids and what it's going to be like for them.
Yeah. Okay.
That's a bit negative to finish on. Come on, we've got to end on a positive note here.
Well, on a positive note, I think we need people like you and all the people I've spoken to, because it's made me feel quite differently about where I come from as well. I just suddenly, I've just opened up my blinkers again, because you just take it for granted. And I just think you should, I don't know, do you do teaching in schools? Do you do talks?
I have done bits, yeah.
Because
And I do enjoy it, and occasionally I know with the school near to us in Cosheston, I've taken kids out onto shorelines and talked about things. I can get passions about talking about the biology and so forth, but I don't have that ability to really capture people's attention.
I disagree. I loved your talk, and I felt really inspired, and what I felt was I want my children to listen to you, because I do think this is just my opinion, but the way it's taught in schools, it should be about real experience and what is on your doorstep, I think the only thing we can do is try and ignite the imagination of our next generation to have a voice, to be aware, and you've got all that experience, so I'm sure you're doing a brilliant job.
Thank you.